I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The autumn of 1982 was an awful time for the Middle East. 21 years ago, Lebanon was at the center of that storm. The streets of Beirut were a war zone with Syrian, Israeli, and Palestinian fighters and their Lebanese factions all fighting for control. Lebanon's new president, Bashir Gemayel, was assassinated before he could be sworn in. His older brother, Amin Gemayel, took his place, and despite his popularity, the shooting and the kidnapping continued. So that's when the young president went to New York, to the UN, with an impassioned plea to end the bloodshed.
We had had enough of bloodshed, enough of destruction, enough of dislocation and despair. We have paid the high price of war. We should not pay an additional price for peace.
And more than anything else, what Amin Gemayel wanted from the UN at that time was a chance to regain sovereignty over Lebanon, to get rid of the influence of outside powers, in effect to allow him to try and build a nation.
I call for the immediate and unconditional withdrawal of all non-Lebanese forces from Lebanon.
Well, it didn't happen. A year later, 241 U.S. Marines, 56 French paratroopers were killed in bombing attacks, and for another 17 years, Israel continued its fight over southern Lebanon. Even today, Syrian soldiers, some 30,000 of them, remain in that country. This is, by some measure, Lebanon's 30th year of occupation. Today on The Connection, my guest is the former president, Amin Gemayel. Connection listeners, we invite your participation. What are the lessons of the failed attempts at nation building in Lebanon? And does the experience of occupation in the land of the Cedars have anything to teach us about U.S. involvement in Iraq today? Our telephone number for you to join us is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 2-3 Talk. My guest is the former president of Lebanon, Amin Gemayel. Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
I was interested to see your name in the news just a couple of months ago because you were, I think, in Baghdad just prior to the war, talking with Saddam Hussein at that time. Is that right?
Yes. Maybe I was the last foreign leader to visit Iraq at that time. It was just maybe 1 week before the war, invited by Saddam Hussein himself. And it was just the last-minute trial. It was my intentions were to try to avoid the war, to get a diplomatic solution. But I knew immediately, I got immediately the impression that the war itself is over.
It's going to happen. Nobody was going to stop it at that time.
It's, when I talk with some U.S. friends, I had the impression that the war is already finished, ended, and they are thinking about the pre-war.
And when you saw Saddam Hussein at that time, Mr. Gemayel, was he confident, looking forward to the war, still interested in peace? What did you see when you met him?
It was amazing. He was very comfortable, very calm, very serene. He came with some cigars, and he offered me a cigar. I said, excuse me, but I don't smoke. I regret after a while not to take the cigar just as a souvenir, because the last cigar from Baghdad, so a good, beautiful story. But in fact, I didn't take it. And he told me something. He told me, you know, when I am anxious and I'm not comfortable, I smoke. I don't smoke. Mm. I smoke when I am at ease with myself, I'm comfortable, I'm calm, so I smoke. So I couldn't imagine the situation was very critical. And I can hear the tanks and weapons and planes, military planes, American, U.S. planes just all around. And how can this guy be so calm, so confident?
This was in March. This was just, as you said, a few days before the bombing of Baghdad began.
Yes.
Was Saddam Hussein at that time talking at all about avoiding war, or was he looking forward to the fight? Was he eager to have this war?
My impression was that he was very confident, and he considered that is able to face the U.S. military invasion, if not by military means, maybe by resistance. And he had the impression that the Iraqis in the desert could harass the U.S. army. And also, in the meantime, the Iraqis in the cities in Baghdad and Basra and so forth can resist and also make another kind of harassment against the U.S. army. So that's why he was confident, and he thought that the party, the Baas party, and the Republican Guard and the intelligence people, all those groups within the Iraqi establishment are able to oppose any kind of threat. That's why he was confident and not eager to go quickly into a settlement.
You like the rest of us, have watched what's happened in Iraq in the last 3 months, and we know that the Americans arrived in Baghdad and the army disappeared. And since that time, the United States has faced some of the problems of any occupying force, of dealing with sniper attacks. It's now becoming a major issue of trying to figure out what's going on. And I guess I'm interested in knowing from you, your analysis of this. You think of your meeting with Saddam Hussein. Is it possible at that time that he was already planning or anticipating this type of resistance, that this would be the way to get back at the Americans, allow them into Baghdad and then harass them day after day?
Maybe. Maybe. I want to say two things. The first is that it seems to me that it's not a classical war. It's not a classic war. It's not a conventional war. It's the war between the CIA, the DIA, and the Iraqis, intelligence people. Mm-hmm. And that it was before the war. We know very well that the surrender of Baghdad wasn't militarily. It was through the CIA, maybe, the infiltration of CIA and the DIA. And also now the Iraqis are trying to respond to through harassment and some such kind of snipers and so forth. That's the first point. It's the war was much more about CIA, DIA, and intelligence tools. And the second point that I it's more positive. So, in my opinion, the Iraqis and the American, both in Iraq and in the United States, there is a deep interest in rebuilding Iraq, rebuilding the institutions, rebuilding the system, rebuilding the economy, rebuilding the another way of life for the Iraqi people themselves. And regardless what's going on, actually, and this the snipers, the harassment, the death of many U.S. and the British soldiers, regardless all this negative point, in my opinion, there is a real chance for a real peace in Baghdad and from Baghdad, from Iraq.
I would have thought you'd have the different perspective. I would have thought that you, as a man who has experienced such awful years of occupation in Lebanon, would say, you know, you can't rebuild a nation as long as there is an occupying force there. It won't work. There will always be this kind of strife on the streets.
The situation is quite different, because I don't think that on the long term, and the as it happens in several places before, in Somalia, in Bosnia, in many other places invaded by the United States, by the U.S. Army, at no time the intentions of the U.S. Army was to remain in those countries, just to accomplish a mission and to leave. And I'm sure that for in Iraq it will be the same. And maybe it will take longer, it will take some time, but a question of years or months or years, the U.S. Army withdraw from Iraq. But in Lebanon, the situation is quite different, because we were occupied by several armies with deep interest in Lebanon, with ambitions, strategic ambitions in Lebanon, like Israel in 78 and 82, and like Syria, which has deep interest in Lebanon, strategic interest, and an old dream. That's why you can't compare what's going on in Lebanon with the Iraqi situation, in my opinion, because of the Iraqi people was involved in very difficult wars. First of all, eight years of war against Iran, and bloodshed war. They let, I don't know, maybe several hundred thousand of death, casualties. And the same after the Iraqis people also had to face the war with Kuwait and the consequences, the embargo and the boycott and so forth. And the Iraqi people suffered a lot.
See, some people might argue with you. They would say that, no, in fact, the U.S. does have a strategic interest in Iraq, and whether we're talking about the attempt to try and change politics in the Middle East, Iraq, Syria, Iran,
yes,
that, all the sort of domino effect.
Yes.
I mean, people,
yes,
I think you could make the case that it's not necessarily in quick strike and come out,
yes,
but a much larger strategic interest, in which case the parallel is, I agree with you, it's not an exact parallel, but it's similar. You know, it's, yes, still the problem of occupation.
what we live actually is the era of the Roman Empire. There is, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there is actually one deus ex machina, one universal deus ex machina, and only one superpower in the world. And the United States is aware of that responsibility, duty, and try to impose its own conception of the international politics all over the world. And the Iraqi war gave the U.S. an opportunity, maybe, to change the mentalities in the area. And what I heard and what I'm experiencing now is a real U.S. trial to change the mentality, the education, to change the political trend in the area toward more democracy, more freedom, that is what we are actually seeing all around.
Connection listeners, my guest is the former president of Lebanon, Amin Gemayel. We're talking about U.S. intentions and U.S. occupation and how that works and doesn't work, particularly in the Middle East. Great long history of different countries and different powers interfering in other countries' affairs. And what are the lessons of Lebanon as we look today at what's going on in Iraq? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK for you to join my conversation this morning with former President of Lebanon, Amin Gemayel. We're going back now to 1982. You know what I'd like to do? I'd like to go back to that moment at the United Nations, because when I listened to the tape,
yes,
earlier, I was hearing a sort of a level of intensity and passion,
yes,
of the debate at that time. I want to just,
you know what, in the Middle East, everything is passion.
but let's listen once again. This is you speaking to the UN Security Council in the fall of 1982. You are 1 month into the job,
yes,
as president,
yes,
and making the case that Lebanon stands not just as an example of foreign occupation, but an example for all of the Middle East in its search for peace.
We now have an opportunity to arrest the cycle of war and chaos. Let us seize it. Peace in Lebanon is obviously a precondition to peace in the Middle East, and no peace in the Middle East without peace in Lebanon.
May I comment a little bit on this point? And really, what I said at that time is still the reality today. And I still insist that no peace in the Middle East if Lebanon didn't recover its sovereignty and independence. And if you allow me, I gave another statement too. It was in Britain. I was in visit, official visit in Britain, and I said something. May I read it?
It's
just a few.
This was when? This
was. It was in 1983.
Okay.
1983, and during a state visit in London, I said.
Can I just interrupt before you begin? 1983. Was this before the attack on the American Marines? Before all the.
Yes, it was between. It was this period.
Okay.
A lot of kidnapping. Hijacking and
the shooting,
etc., against foreigners, the rise of the terrorism. It wasn't at all about military campaigns, or it was about terrorism. So I said at that time, I said at that time in December 1983, the fire of the ordeal, it means the terrorist attack. That has touched the people of Lebanon will very soon, if unchecked, spread throughout the Arab world and the Middle East. The livelihood and the existence of the European nations will in turn become threatened, resulting in a wider conflict unless something is done now to avert the danger. Taking small risk today obviates the need for greater risk to be taken tomorrow. So, is that what I said? And it was before the 11th September, before all the...
It was 20 years before.
20 years. I said, what it kind of a vision. In 1983, I was thinking about what could happen in New York, on in the Champs-Élysées in Paris, or in London.
Let's see if we can go back to that. And I know that we don't have the time in 1 hour to resolve the difficulties of Lebanon. But at that point, you had the Israeli army occupying one-third of the southern half of your country. You had the Syrian army occupying another third of Lebanon at that point. I mean, I may be a little bit off here. And then you had a bunch of other foreign powers, the French and the Americans, the Iranians,
the Turks,
the Palestinians,
the Libyans,
all in the other third of the country.
Yes. So, and you have to mention also the financing of this war in Lebanon and the foreign interventions and infiltration. I met a very important person from Libya. He told me that Gaddafi paid about $1 billion to fuel the Lebanese war. And I know that the Iraqis and the Syrians and others paid as much as that. But that's a recognition from Libya that they spent $1 billion to fuel the Lebanese war at that time.
But you will also remember that after your speech at the UN, 1,500 U.S. Marines came to Beirut.
Yes.
They stayed for about a year. Nobody was really sure why they were there, but they were there as part of an international force. It was an attempt.
Yes.
And then when there was the truck bomb that killed 241 of them, shortly after that, they left.
Yes.
And I want you to look back at that for us this morning and tell us what might have been different. So earlier in the program, you were saying that the United States' hallmark was that they wouldn't stay for a long time, that they'd go in, fix a problem, and they'd leave.
Yes.
But when they left Lebanon to another 17 years of chaos.
Yes. Instead of doing what they did during World War II, after World War II, there was the Truman Doctrine and the Marshall Plan. Instead of doing that and really doing a lot of effort to help Lebanon restore its sovereignty and democracy, they did what they did after World War I, which is to liberate Europe and to leave also behind them chaos. So, unfortunately, it was the first choice, the World War World War I choice. At that time when I took office, I got assurances from the West, from the Reagan's administration and from President Mitterrand and many other leaders, and the many Arab leaders too, that they will help Lebanon restore sovereignty and independence. Unfortunately, they weren't ready at that time to fight the terrorism, to fight such kind of behavior that you are facing now. And that's why the terrorists spread not only in Lebanon, but also all in the whole world. And that's the experience that we had, that we retained from.
You had three choices at that time, if I recall it correctly. You had the Syrian option, which would be to have tried to stay with the Syrians in an attempt to try and regain some control over Lebanon. That was your least favorite. You had the Israeli option, having the Christian parties in Lebanon work with Israel to try and establish some control. And then there was the American option.
I suppose this your point of view. There were two options, that's all. Because the first one, the Israeli option, the Syrian option, and the Christian option, or maybe a Muslim option, are only one option. There are one option. The Israeli option and the Syrian option were one option, because both were seeking the partition and the domination, the hegemony, and so forth. And a Christian option is also similar to the Israeli and the Syrians, because they are implementing a kind of ghetto, Christian ghetto, and help to also the others to maintain their grip and their hegemony. So there are, in my opinion, there were two options, and until now, it's the same. The first option is to liberate Lebanon and to rebuild the real democratic system, and we have an opportunity for that. It's feasible. And the other option is to maintain the foreign to the foreign armies on our soil and to maintain the situation as it is, very volatile and without any kind of democracy, freedom, and so forth. So those are the two options.
But you chose
that we were facing in 1982, and we are still facing for the time being.
You chose at that time as president the American option, looking for the assistance, right?
I didn't adopt the American option, but with my discussions with President Reagan, I got the assurances that the American will help Lebanon restore its sovereignty, as well as the many other countries like France, like Egypt, like the Saudi Arabia, who help a lot.
And what went wrong?
Lebanon to restore its sovereignty. So it wasn't a American option or a Saudi option or a French option. It was the option of a Lebanon free, democratic, and independent.
All right, but you're still looking for outside assistance to help reestablish control over Lebanon. What I want to hear from you is what went wrong.
Just one point. Because in Lebanon, the Lebanese crisis has two dimensions. The first one is domestic, and the other one is international. So the international dimensions is actually the heavier, and with the foreign interferences in our domestic affair are preventing us to handle the domestic dimensions. That's why we need to stop the foreign interferences in our domestic affairs. We need to free Lebanon from the foreign hegemonies and foreign interventions.
So what went wrong with the effort to try and include American assistance to make that the way out? Because it didn't work.
We were the victim of the notion of realpolitik, because at that time, if you were talking about 1983, don't forget that it was at the eve of the re-election of President Reagan. And the Reagan's team were eager to get the U.S. Army outside of this Lebanese burden. And they let us alone confronting the difficulties that you were mentioning now.
Connection listeners, my guest is the former president of Lebanon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. In this hour, a chance to talk about what lessons from U.S. involvement in the Middle East through the eyes of the former president in Lebanon and what that teaches us about American involvement today in Iraq. Mr. Jamal, when you look at what's going on in Iraq today, do you see a way for this to have an ending which is good for both the Iraqis and the Americans?
I think so. I hope so, and I think so. I'm quite optimistic, contrary to many others here in Washington, in Boston. I'm quite optimistic because I know the Iraqi people, and I know the intentions of the administration here. And I know that everybody actually is willing to get rid of this dirty mess. Mm-hmm. The Iraqis are really tired after about 20 years of heavy it's very severe conditions. And they want to get rid of this old days of sufferances and pains. Lot of them, mainly the elite in Iraq, want to work with the United States and try to build a new Iraq. What is required for the time being is a real partnership between the United States and the Iraqi elite. The U.S. should trust the Iraqi elite and help this Iraqi elite to handle by themselves their domestic affairs.
So was it then a mistake to use the exiles, the Iraqi exiles, as the attempt to involve Iraqis, the Iraqi National Congress? Would the Americans have been better off to go into Baghdad and to work with the people who have been in that country? Would that have...
Yes, maybe you are right. I would have preferred a partnership with the people who knows very well the field, know the people, right, and suffered with the Iraqi people in Iraq during those 20 years of war. But in the meantime, also outside Iraq, there were a lot of people very wise, very intelligent, and sincere would like to help. So we don't have to discriminate between the outside and the inside. But for sure that it would have been better to focus first on the people on the field.
But you know that when we read the newspapers in America today, this is not about any cooperation in Iraq between the Iraqis and the Americans. It's about the attacks on the American soldiers. It's about tapes from Saddam Hussein telling people,
yes,
to rise up against these people. Are you saying that...
That the negative aspect, the bottle half empty, but also you have to focus on the positive aspect. And I know that a lot of people in Iraq, the Iraqis, who are willing to cooperate, they are cooperating. And politically, the tribes, for instance, are really willing to cooperate. Many statements given by religious men in Baghdad, Shia and Sunni, also calling for a cooperation with the American army and trying to avoid the military resistance. They are saying, okay, we will resist politically, but in the meantime, trying to work with the American to go very fast in rebuilding our institutions and get rid of the American military presence in Iraq.
Do you subscribe to what has been called here in the United States the domino theory, where real change in Iraq begins change in a number of other countries? And I'm thinking specifically in your own area of expertise. Mm. We see the American occupation of Iraq at the same time as we see the Americans telling the Syrians,
yes,
stay within your own boundaries.
So,
don't help the Iraqis. Don't get caught here. And I was thinking in anticipation of our conversation, so does that mean that this could be good news for Lebanon if Syria is kept within its boundary? Does that mean this is the domino theory, that what happens in Iraq will have an effect all over the Middle East?
It's very simple. the regime change in Iraq will affect the whole area. It's normal. You can't separate the American presence in Iraq from the whole region. The neighboring country will be affected directly. It's very normal. It's you don't have to be an expert in the area to understand that a Syrian, a American presence in Iraq with the American intentions to change the mentalities in the area, the education of the area, to push the area toward more democracy and freedom, for sure it will affect not only Syria, it will affect also Iran. And now we see what's going on in Iran with the students' uprising, between brackets, what's going on in Saudi Arabia, what's going on in Jordan, and in Syria too. So it's not a question of domino theory. It's very normal. It's a dynamic, a momentum in the area. And that's why the elites, the people, and also the governments in the area should learn a real lesson from what's going on, actually. And they can't avoid the reality, which is a momentum in the area, in the Middle East, toward a real change. If you want, I can compare what's going on actually in 2003 in the Middle East. I could compare that to what went on in 1952 after the Nasser revolution in Egypt. And this revolution in 52 changed the whole regimes in the area, in Iraq and in Syria and everywhere. So what's going on actually in 2003? It's a kind of anti-1952, anti-revolution to move toward a complete different dynamic and direction.
Connection listeners, a chance to interact with a man whose entire political career has been involved with different forms of nation building in the Middle East. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Amin Jamal, former president of Lebanon, is my guest this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from... You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. From 1982 to 1988, one of the most complicated and bloody times in Lebanon's history, the president was Amin Jemayel. After 1988, with the country still in turmoil, he spent a very brief time in the United States, but also 12 years in Paris, in exile. He's now back in Lebanon, involved in politics there. And he's my guest this hour. We would like to have you in on the conversation. We're going to go first to Hillsborough, North Carolina, and Claude is with us. Hi, Claude.
Hey, how you doing today?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Maharaba, Mr. President. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I have a question. I was kind of curious. Do you feel that maybe the U.S. government does not show the interest they should in Lebanon?
You mean, Claude, should the United States government put Lebanon on its list of countries where soldiers could go to be of assistance?
Not necessarily soldiers, but right. Possibly, you know, get the United Nations involved in giving Lebanon the freedom and independence that it needs, because I would think that the United States would realize that a stable, independent government in Lebanon would be to the interest of the United States, especially being as it borders Israel, and with all the other turmoil that exists there right now, I would think that the United States would put it on its list of priorities. You know, they single out Syria as a country that sponsors terrorism, and you would think that they would try to remove the Syrian influence from Lebanon.
Okay, Claude, let's see what Mr. Jamal has to say. Thanks for your question.
I'm sure that the U.S. intentions toward Lebanon are very clear. The U.S. Would like to see a free, independent Lebanon, but unfortunately, it's a question of priorities, and maybe the priority is, for the time being, elsewhere. And looking for in Lebanon is to get rid of any kind of foreign hegemony and to let the Lebanese decide by themselves their future. there is actually an important platform, which is the Taif Accord of 1989. This accord has been convened upon by all the Lebanese factions, endorsed by the Arab League and by the United Nations, and approved by with the blessing of the United States. The only what we are calling for is the full implementation of this Taif Accord, which requires the withdrawal of the Syrian from the Syrian withdrawal of the Syrian army from Lebanon.
But Syria is in no hurry to go. So, in answer to Claude's question, what's it going to take? Will it take UN involvement, American involvement? What will it take to get the Syrian troops out of Lebanon?
So we hope that Syria is convinced that a genuine dialogue with the Lebanese, through a government of national unity in Lebanon, which will conduct a negotiation with Syria how to arrange for the best relations between Lebanon and Syria, a relations which could respect the sovereignty of Lebanon and free Lebanon from the foreign armies which exist on our soil.
1-800-423-8255. Claude, thanks for that call. Let's go to Cyrus, who's calling in from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Cyrus.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. I just have a question to Mr. Jumeir. There's a view among some people, including Thomas Friedman in the same book that was quoted earlier, that President Jumeir involved the Lebanese party in his clampdown on different militias in the country. He was unfairly clamping down on certain factions, whereas the Falangists, who was found by Mr. Jumeir's father, were left unchecked. And so this conflict made some people feel that the Marines were also there helping Mr. Jumeir in his control over the army against another faction of Lebanese. And this may have...
Cyrus, let me ask you a question. Do you mean that someone like Mr. Jumeir, who is a politician and represents the Christians, is a member of the Falangist Party, then can't rule the country because he represents only one group of people in the country?
No, I don't think it's based on who you represent or how you were born, but it's also your actions. And after actions have taken place, I don't think the Muslims had a problem when Mr. Jumeir was elected as much as after when he was elected. There were some there was a general feeling that the army was being biased towards a certain group. And so certainly the presence of Israeli troops didn't help that view. So I was just wondering, and Mr. Friedman also makes a description of the facts that could, you know, lead to this assumption, to this conclusion.
All right, let's hear from Mr. Jumeir.
So thank you for this question, but I want only to remind everybody that the Israeli army invaded Lebanon before I took office. So my only duty was to get rid of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. And also, the American didn't come at all to salvage my regime, because also the American came into Lebanon before I took office. U.S. Army came into Lebanon in July, and I took office in September. So they didn't come at all to rescue anybody, but they came into Lebanon just to assure a minimum of security and to secure the Palestinian camps around Beirut after the withdrawal of the Israeli army from the capital itself. So now I don't want to go into details, because it's not now time to discuss some Lebanese domestic affairs, especially related to the 80s. I think that now we should look at the future and not to be completely entrenched in such a period. And I think that it's not at all in the interest of anybody, not in the interest of the Palestinians, the interest of many other factions in Lebanon, to return to this era.
I want to ask you a question, though, about a formula that Lebanon used to use for governing, because I think that it could be instructive in looking at what will work in Iraq, what will work in other parts of the Middle East. And I think it may have been your father, Pierre Gemayel, who devised a formula where the president would be.
No, it was before.
Before him?
Yes.
Okay, but let's talk about what the formula was. Yes. The president would be a Christian. The prime minister would be a Sunni Muslim. The speaker of the parliament would be a Shiite Muslim.
Yes.
And that was one idea for resolving some of the difficulties that would exist in a country as complicated as Lebanon. But I'm wondering if in your experience you think it's in any way, under any circumstances, possible to run a country where the parties are communally based and religious based, or whether or not it isn't a recipe for some kind of fighting that always goes beyond political fighting and becomes fighting in the street.
First, let me remind you that there is absolutely nothing in the constitution, national constitution, or in the law, Lebanese law, which said that the president should be Christian, the prime minister Sunni, and speaker Shia. There is absolutely nothing. It's just traditions.
Customs.
And we agreed upon liberally, spontaneously, to go into this distribution. It's just a kind of power sharing to avoid that any factions dictate its will to another faction. It's a kind of power sharing, national power sharing, which secure a minimum of power sharing, minimum of security in the country. So now there is, as I've said, in 1989, we agreed upon a new charter, a new consensus, which is the Taif Agreement.
This is a formula for the Second Republic of Lebanon.
A new formula. And we have just to respect this new agreement, which is very clear and specific. And maybe it's a way out for, it's the answer for many, many questions and concerns. And could build a new consensus among the various Lebanese factions.
1-800-423-8255. Next call to, we're going to Wellesley, Massachusetts. Ken's on the line. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Thank you very much for an excellent program.
Thanks for your call. Go ahead.
Okay, if we can go back to 1983-84 to an incident that may link up to the present.
Okay.
You've discussed the bombing of the Marine barracks, the 240 dead Marines.
Yeah.
But we haven't really talked about the aftermath. Immediately after the bombing, the Marines sat there for a while, and then several months later, as they were withdrawing, the battleship New Jersey pulled up offshore and fired about 288 one-ton shells into the Shouf, into the hills behind Beirut.
Mm-hmm.
A couple questions on this. How many Lebanese died during that shelling, and what effect did that shelling have on politics within Lebanon?
Are you saying that the shelling was a type of retribution, a type of revenge for that, or just cover for the departure of the Marines?
It wasn't covering fire for the withdrawal. This was, again, several months later. There were a number of missions where destroyers were firing fire suppression rounds, but this was a fairly indiscriminate shelling. There was a court of inquiry into it by the U.S. Navy.
What is it that you're driving at, Ken? Where do you want to go with this?
Well, where I want to go with this is, first, we now sit in a situation where U.S. forces are obviously exposed to potential acts of violence.
Yeah.
And the issue of how the U.S. should respond when forces suffer from truck bombings or equivalent attacks is something which may well arise again. Looking back to really the core of the president's administration, if we go back to the mid-'80s, this took place on his watch. Did he request the shelling, and was it something that had bad or good effects on his position within Lebanon? Did it have the effect of polarizing Lebanese politics? Because there's a bit of mystery as to why this took place.
And what the effects of that were?
Our friend who is raising this question is focusing on the American reaction and riposte. But he didn't mention the foreign interferences, the foreign hegemony or foreign military intervention in Lebanon. Because as we all know, at that time, Lebanon was occupied by the Syrians and by the Israelis some groups coming from Iran, the Pasdaran, and the Palestinians, the PLO, were still very active on our soil. And I don't know how you can deal with all those factions, with those militias and armies, with what? With peanuts or with...
If I can, take Ken's question, because we're short for time, maybe a couple of minutes left in the program.
Yes,
I think what he's getting at here is your sense of how important it is for the American troops to behave in Iraq. As they're being attacked now, how important is it for the American troops not to get caught up in some kind of revenge or being seen to be too aggressive in Iraq?
If you don't mean to talk about the Lebanese affair, okay, a Lebanese issue, you want to focus on the Iraqis, I'll tell you that the answer to your question is a real partnership between the U.S. and the Iraqi elite and the Iraqi people. Mm-hmm. That's the answer. The Americans are convinced by this approach and to go forward with some elite and to forget a little bit about many other negative factors.
So the danger is in separating themselves, being too far apart from all Iraqis. That's the danger, in your view, that they need to be a part of this society.
In my opinion, there is a minority who is fighting the United States in Iraq. The response to that is to rebuild very quickly the Iraqi institutions through the Iraqi themselves. The Americans should help the Iraqi themselves to rebuild their institutions and not to impose upon the Iraqis their institutions. That is the question, a question of partnership.
Well, I wish we had another hour to talk more, because your sense of the history of that entire area is very useful in helping us understand it. Mr. Amin Jamal, thank you for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.